Joan Anderson, and I'm an associate member here. I was until recently the chair of the Associate Members Committee, and it's my very great pleasure to be able to introduce one of our most famous and notorious associate members, Arudo De Vito, who I think you all know quite well. He is a Japanese citizen, as his name might suggest, and he is an associate professor at Hokkaido Information University. He's also the author of several acclaimed books, the first of which you might have heard of is called Japanese Only, the Otaru Hot Springs Case and Racial Discrimination in Japan. And he's also written a handbook for newcomers, migrants, immigrants to Japan, and both of these have also been the subject of book breaks here at the SECJ. And it's a real shame that tonight we have a little competition from the TEPCO shareholders meeting, which unfortunately quite a few journalists for some strange reason seem to have chosen to cover. It's quite hard to understand why, but anyway. So we really do appreciate those who have come, and as one person has commented to me this evening, it's a shame there aren't more Japanese people in the audience, but we really welcome the one who is here.
Two, three.
Two, three, yes, exactly. I did say in the audience. Can I ask you all to turn off your phones? You probably have already. Just to try and give you a couple of minor facts you might not know about our speaker, he's 128th Cherokee. Did anybody know that?
Apparently. You did your
research. And his original name is David Christopher Schofield. Sorry about that. And he himself has been through several changes of name. Now, obviously, tonight's book has also had an interesting name, and the story of how it got that name is quite fascinating too. Perhaps you'll comment on that. It's Inappropriate, a novel of culture, kidnapping, and revenge in modern Japan. And I think probably for most of the audience, the fact that the theme relates to parents who are unable to have access to their children after kidnapping or abduction of one sort or another is, I think most of you are aware of that. And obviously there is an element of autobiography in there somewhere, which I think it would be interesting to get some comment on too. So I won't go on any longer. I think De Vito is going to speak with a PowerPoint for about 20 minutes, and then we'll be welcoming all your questions. Thank you very much.
If I speak at this volume, how's that, or should I bring the microphone closer? Closer? All right, here it comes. All right. Is this on? No, it's not. That's why. Let's try that. Okay. How's that? All right, then. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for coming out this evening, and of course, thank you for that marvelous introduction. I have not had that much research done on me by people that... But we're not internet stalkers, so no, trust me. There are some of them out there, and I am really happy to have you all here tonight. I'd like the format of this evening to be fun. You paid your money. Let's sit down. Let's get through my presentation to give you an idea of what the book is about, and we'll just open the floor to questions and have a good time. How's that sound? And then after that, we repair to the bar and get some beer. Sound good? That's the type of atmosphere I'd like for this evening. All right. So, we're going to be looking at this screen the whole evening. We're going to be looking at the screen the whole evening. Thank you. So, please, everybody, if you're not in a position where you're going to give yourself whiplash, please move yourself in a position so you can watch the screen, because there are visuals, there's text, etc. The good news is that you can download this entire PowerPoint presentation right here. My website is davito.org, and I've uploaded this presentation, so if you want to take notes, or if there's information here you want to have for posterity, you'll be able to download it from there, or, of course, from my blog tomorrow. It'll be my blog entry for tomorrow. All right? So, anyway, that's That's the start for the book. Now, first of all, there's the cover of the book. How many people have actually read the book? Be honest. Okay. All right. And how many people intend to read the book?
Oh.
That's the spirit. Thank you. I can't tell you how heartening that is to an author to know that he's going to be read. And for people that have not read the book yet, I'd like to tell you a bit about it, since most have not read it yet. That's fine. There's the cover. And I've written other books, as Joan has mentioned. There's the first one I wrote, which is from Akashi Shoten. Japanese only, the Japanese version right there, also the English version. These are still on sale. They're not out of print quite yet, so if you still want to read about the Otada Onsen's case, where they had a bathhouse that threw up the sign saying Japanese only, and how we took the case all the way to the Japanese Supreme Court over the course of 5 years, well, it's all there, English and Japanese, so no excuses. So those were the first two books I've written. I've also written another book that was mentioned this evening, The Handbook for Newcomers, Migrants, and Immigrants to Japan. And this is now book number 4. Now, why this book is different is because it's a fiction work. All my other books so far have been nonfiction. I really wanted to try and stretch my legs and see if I could actually write fiction. And the results may or may not be mixed. I've had one friend say he didn't quite like the book the way he wanted to, but that's fine. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. We had Ben over there who said, I have his review up here on the PowerPoint presentation. I'll quote from it. And Joan, did you?
I enjoyed it a lot, apart from the chapter on picking up girls in high school.
Yes, I bet. That's unfortunately very much symptomatic of the lad culture that you get in certain small corners of the world.
It was very honest.
Yes. My apologies. That's not autobiographical. Trust me. That's not me. But the point is, I wanted to try and create characters that were not anything to do with me, but were an amalgam of several different people. So, what is the book about? It's about a character named Gary Schmidt, who is a small-town American boy who meets a Japanese girl in college and follows her to Japan to start a family. And as it says in the back cover of the book, little does he know that a conservative Japanese clan has hidden agendas and secret intentions. And Gary eventually realizes that he must escape their clutches and convince his family to do the same before it's too late. Now, that's just a teaser. It doesn't say much about the people that are left behind, parents that may have a stake in this, have a dog in this fight. How many people are, as we say, left behind parents? In other words, after a divorce, have been denied almost all of their access to their child or children. Only one? Okay, two. But that is the subject of this book, one of the subjects. So, I just gave the teaser summary on the back. I'll give you a little bit more. Inappropriate is a book about child abductions in Japan, where, after a divorce, a non-Japanese man comes to Japan to retrieve his children back to America. Although it is a work of fiction, as I said, it is an amalgam of several true stories of divorce and left-behind parents in Japan. And if you'd like to see examples of these stories, there's a referential website at the very bottom called the Children's Rights Network, and it's crnjapan.net. Go and take a look at it. It's got a lot of rather sad stories, and the occasional victory, but not too many. It's a problem that in Japan is not being addressed. This book is an attempt to at least popularize the subject, if you will. It's not much of a word, but it's to get more people aware that this is happening. Most people that don't really know much about Japan that have read this book have said, you got to be kidding. This can't be so. Guess what? It is, because these are true stories. And if you doubt that, go again to the CRN Japan website and take a look. I'll give you even a little bit more. Inappropriate is more than just about divorce. I wanted to describe how a person would find fascination in Japan and Japanese people and come over during Japan's bubble era to see Japan ripe with opportunity and find out how Japan went sour as an economy over the past two decades. I'm actually talking as a bubble era veteran. How many people came over here during the bubble? Remember the bubble? Yeah?
Before.
Yes, even before the bubble. It was a very different place, wasn't it? Well, he comes to Japan, finds it a fascinating place, and then I give economics, statistics, and talk about how Japan went sour, the system that soured, to quote another author. And it was a nice challenge for me to do it. I wanted to recount this as a bubble era veteran. And remember in the late 1980s? Japan needed to look poised to take over the world. Japan, with people like Chalmers Johnson, said it was challenging notions of how capitalism worked. And I wanted to see how, step by step, Japanese society would be squeezed and squeezed, convinced that recovery was right around the corner, just like Godot, waiting for Godot, who never comes. We're still waiting for the planned recovery, the shoots. It's not going to happen. Not as far as I can see. And finally, Inappropriate tells the story of how a person could assimilate himself to the point of founding his own company, becoming bilingual in Japanese, and even taking Japanese citizenship, yet be blindsided by events that were nearly always beyond his control. It is also a time capsule charting Japan's descent into mediocrity and comparative international irrelevance. That's a pretty tall order for a book, isn't it? But that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to tell about a character who comes over, sees Japan, talk about Japan in that context, and then talk about what happens all around him. So, I took on a lot of things with this book. We'll see if I succeeded. But some people thought I did, so here's some words of praise. Sorry. Here we go. Excuse me. One Left Behind parent said, Inappropriate is a work of fiction, but full of fact. I read the book twice, once to check the facts and once to feel the emotions. There is no other way to describe this but say that on both fronts, the book hits home. Many people reading this will not believe it, but as somebody that has been there and done that, I can honestly say this is one of the most powerful books I've ever read. I like that. I'm pleased for that sort of praise. Another friend of mine said, books on Japan can be a real chore to get through, but Davita writes fluidly and smoothly. Inappropriate is a well-constructed story which highlights a number of important issues regarding the rights of non-Japanese in Japan, with more than a few pointers for anyone considering setting up here. Thankfully, my experience with Japan is very different than that described in the novel, and I don't think the book is intended in any way to represent a typical experience, but it graphically brings home what can happen if things don't work out. Recommended. All right. This is a former editor at Pearson Education, who unfortunately is moving town, so he couldn't give me a review for ELT News. So, but he gave me that. He gave me that review. A little more. Somebody else who knows something about this? The article gave me this depiction of how quickly life gets turned upside down by the crazy family ties in Japan will do more than just grab your attention. It will make you cry at the strange and deplorable tale of love lost in Japan. Inappropriate sheds necessary light on the twisted norms and laws in Japan that not only allow, but also encourage parents to abduct their children from one another. Another Left Behind parent. And I look forward to seeing what Steve has to say about this book after he finishes reading it too, as a Left Behind parent. And finally, Ben Stubbings, who is in the audience this evening, he's my editor at the Japan Times. He's going to hide behind his glass. But he said something very nice. Inappropriate? I found Inappropriate difficult to put down. Surely the best compliment for any book, and if anything, it was over too soon. A book that needed to be written about an important, still unresolved issue every parent in Japan should be aware of. And Ben gave me that interview in lieu of a interview in the Japan, a review in the Japan Times. The Japan Times, I'm told, is boycotting the book.
One person.
Well, the person that's in the veto gate position, who's in charge of the book reviews, has said, quote, I get too much exposure. I guess he's not going to be reviewing the Madonna's book anytime soon, because she's probably overexposed too, but still. If you want to read what more people are saying, on my website, there's davito.org/inappropriate.html. That's the accurate site for it. Well, maybe Japan sometimes will change their mind. Here's hoping. But this is the second book I sent to them. The first one mysteriously disappeared. Now, let's talk about something more than just the book. Let's talk about the bigger picture here. And I want to talk about the issue of child abductions, because that is at heart what we should be more concerned about. I mean, talking about the book is one thing, but if I keep on going, it's going to sound self-aggrandizing. Let's talk about the bigger thing. Now, what causes these? Am I exaggerating about child abductions? I don't think I am. Anybody that's been through a divorce in Japan is going to know that Japan's laws are not going to protect both parents. They essentially protect one parent, and usually the mother. Now, you might say that's the same in every society. In most societies, it's usually the mother that gets custody of the children. Yes, but a couple of things. Japan's divorce laws remain.
Yes. Just ask a question.
Of course.
Is that the case if the mother isn't Japanese?
I will get to that in a second, but in cases where the mother is not Japanese, if the Japanese father abducts the kids, it's a matter of habitual residence. And it's very difficult, unless you re-abduct your children back into your custody, to get the kids out of the habitual residence. In other words, if you take it to court, the judge will say, well, they've been living there for X number of months, therefore we don't want to uproot them from the current lifestyle, so, well, who dares wins, is the point.
So basically you're saying that the law is on the side of the Japanese parent.
The law is on the side of the parent with custody in general, which is usually the mother, because the mother is usually the one that realizes, okay, get out while the going is good, but the father can do it, of course, too. Usually on the side of the abductor. Is that a fair assessment, would you say, Steve?
Yeah. Why don't you do your presentation? We can do the questions and answers after.
All right. Japan's divorce laws have been fundamentally unaltered since for over 100 years. Now, why is that important? You can't get a certain type of regular divorce like you do in other countries. There are three different types of divorces in Japan. The first type is kyogirikon, which is where both sides say, okay, we don't like each other, let's call it quits, and say, okay, we just arrived at Narita back from our honeymoon from Hawaii. We don't, and you know, Narita rikon, you just say, okay, that's enough, if you had it. And if both sides put their incomes on the divorce form, that's it, you're divorced. It can't be as simple as that. The problem is that you also have to, if one person doesn't agree or wants to be nasty about it, then you have to keep on saying, please, let's be nice to each other. Let's make this a clean break. And the other person says, no, I want something from you, like lots of money, or the kids, or the house, or something like that. And if you can play ball outside of a courtroom, go to chote, which is a negotiation, then you have to make a case to people that your marriage is broken. You cannot cite something like irreconcilable differences. That's seikaku no fuichi in Japanese. You cannot say, we just don't like each other. You have to show the people, the authorities, that your marriage was a living hell. That you are just not, even if your marriage wasn't a living hell, my marriage wasn't a living hell. And yet I had to portray it as that to be convincing. If you don't, then the judge is just going to say, well, just persevere. Or the people that are in charge are going to say, well, you know, obviously there's some room for improvement, so improve it. You cannot just... The reasons for divorce are not modernized enough. And they're not going to be modernized enough when you have them over 100 years old. All right? So, we can come back to this slide, of course, later if we have further questions. Next. Japan's family registry system does not allow for joint custody after divorce. And this is crucial. We have the koseki system here in this society where you have families that will register their names. Like, for example, if you get married, like let's say Mr. Suzuki marries Mrs. Tanaka, then Mr. and Mrs. Suzuki, usually, will go on the same koseki, the same family registry, as one of the spouse members, usually the husband. In other words, she is stricken from her own family registry and goes on his. So you're essentially all in one family. Now, what happens is that in the event of a divorce, one name is removed from Tanaka's, from Mr. Suzuki's family registry. So Ms. Suzuki will become Ms. Suzuki on a different koseki, or becomes Ms. Tanaka all over again. But what happens to the kids? The kids have to go on one person's koseki. They can't go on both. So there is no joint custody in this society. Only one parent legally has custody of the children. And why that makes it so difficult I'll tell you a bit more later in my example, is that essentially they don't see you as the legal guardian of that child, therefore they don't see you as having any right to that child, any right of access whatsoever. For example, in my case, I couldn't even get access to my children's grades at school. I would call the school and say, how are my kids doing? And they say, well, we're under no obligation to tell you. I said, why not? I'm the father. He says, you're not on her koseki. Therefore, you don't have any legal tie to the children. But I'm paying child support, and I'm paying the mortgage on the house. I'm supporting them. Yes, but you don't have any legal title to them, so we have no legal obligation to give you any information. It's a privacy issue now. So, when you don't have joint custody, you don't have joint access. There's no way to guarantee it. Now, you do have visitation rights, so to speak, if they're granted by a court. They're not automatic. So what happens is, if you want to say, I want to see my children, you can go to court and say, I have the right to at least visit them, right? And they'll say, maybe, maybe not, but you have to go to court to do it. And court will take some time, and there's going to be a lot of fur flying in that courtroom. There could be a lot of lying going on. And the magic word to use in this, if you want to deny any visitation rights to your children, is to say, he was violent towards me, or the children. And that's been used in a lot of cases, even though there's no evidence. And they'll say, well, you know, the father was probably rough towards his wife sooner or later, so we'll talk about this in a little bit. Domestic violence or something like that. And what happens? Even if you are granted joint custody, even if you are granted visitation rights, in Steve's case, as he mentioned, he was granted 36 hours per year. Right?
That's what the Tokyo Family Court suggested. That's what they offered me.
Right. That's their idea of equitable visitation. Three times a year, 36 hours total, he was offered. That's inhumane, but that's all they're going to guarantee in that sort of situation. Mm-hmm. So, 2 hours a month. Thanks very much. So, anyway, even if you are granted it, all she has to do is just deny you a visitation. You have to go back to court all over again to get it enforced. It's an unenforceability. And I want to stress, this is not a foreigner-Japanese issue. This is regardless of nationality. This happens to everyone in Japan. You go through a divorce, one parent disappears. That is the norm. The most famous case of that is Koizumi. Prime Minister Koizumi, who didn't see his child, and his youngest son, until the youngest son was in his 20s. A little more. Now, non-Japanese, I'm going to use the word NJ for non-Japanese, I hate the word foreigner, are particularly disadvantaged in this situation because they have no family registry in Japan. They cannot be written as a family member on the family registry. They can be put as a comment to say you married this person, but before I naturalized, on the family registry, I'm not written in the husband column. I'm just written as the person that married this woman down below that's registered as the head of household. So, and gave birth to these children, but I'm still not the legal father, even there, if I was a non-Japanese here. I'm listed on there, fortunately, but the problem is after a divorce, what makes it so difficult is the children can't come to your family registry as your children because you don't have one. So what happens? Very often, the child has to become the head of household. You have to be put on your son's or daughter's koseki if you actually have custody of your children as a non-Japanese. And, if you have a spouse visa, for example, you lose that because you got a divorce. You're not a spouse anymore. And if you come from another country overseas, as Joan and I were talking a little earlier, a friend of hers is having enormous problems because he had to give up everything he had in his home country after his wife abducted the children back to Japan, and he's living over here on a shoestring budget just so he can see his kids. So you have an intercontinental issue here as well that makes things particularly difficult. And he who dares wins. Cases of abduction to Japan from abroad. And the Murray Wood case is a case in point right here. Murray Wood was a Canadian in British Columbia. In Vancouver, his wife abducted his son and daughter on a pretense of coming back for a family visit, just didn't come back. he was granted custody by this British Columbia Supreme Court to have custody of his kids. He took that over to a Japanese court, signed them up. They refused to acknowledge it. They would not give him custody of his own kids in Japan. They simply said, well, we don't want to uproot the kids from their own, from their habitual residence. Now, if you think I'm exaggerating, take a look at this. This is from the U.S. State Department. This is January 2011. The U.S. State Department has observed, however, that foreign parents are greatly disadvantaged in Japanese courts, both in terms of obtaining the return of children to the United States and achieving enforceable visitation rights in Japan. The Department of State is not aware of any case in which a child taken from the United States by one parent has been ordered returned to the United States by Japanese courts, even when left behind parent has a U.S. custody degree. So there's a source right there. It's from the U.S. Department of State website. So, in other words, once they're brought over here, they're not turned back. And you might think, isn't it the same in all countries? Okay, two words, Eli and Gonzalez. The Cuban boy that came over on a boat was repatriated to his father back over in Cuba from the United States for no other reason but because he was the one that had custody. That happened 10 years ago. So it's not happening over here. Now, in sum, one parent after divorce in Japan is generally expected to disappear. Parental alienation syndrome is the norm and will continue as such. Now, we hear word that Japan will eventually sign the Hague Treaty on Child Abductions. It's literally the Hague Convention on Civil Aspects of Child Abduction. That's the official title. Japan has not signed it. It's the only G8 country that has not. But I anticipate that Japan will actually exceptionalize itself out of enforcement. What do I mean by that? It will find loopholes in the treaty to say, we'll sign it, but we're not going to enforce it. You heard that before? Like the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination in 1996, Japan still has no law against racial discrimination. Because they say, well, foreigners, they don't deserve the same rights as Japanese because they're foreigners. They can naturalize if they want. They're going to exceptionalize here. How are they going to do it? Like this. Domestic violence. An example is this. Domestic debate on DV, domestic violence, is making even acts of non-violence into violence, disadvantaging fathers in negotiation. And I'm going to give you an example of where the debate's going. There's an NPO called Saya Saya. It's at that web link right there, dv.org, etc. And it's going to loop Japan out of the Hague Treaty. Here, this is how we're going to define domestic violence. What they're going to say is, we will return your child as long as there is no history of domestic violence. Okay, how do we define that? Here we go. DV, as defined at npo.sayasaya.net, human rights website. This is one example. Okay, there are two checklists. This has been up on my blog last week. There's a women's checklist, and if you've experienced any of these things, you are a victim of domestic violence. Okay, there are some out there that have some ground to them, like my husband beat me. Okay, yeah, okay, that's perfectly all right. But take a look at these. For example, I always try to wear clothes that he likes. That's domestic violence. When I go out alone, he calls my cell phone regularly. That's domestic violence. He's reluctant to associate with my friends and parents. He's angry if I come home late. He sulks if I deviate in any way from what he requested of me. This is from Japan. This is translated from the original Japanese. If you want me to see it, I have it online. I'll bring it up. I'm relieved when he is not around. These are all examples of domestic violence towards women. There's also a checklist for men. If you did these things, you are a perpetrator of domestic violence. Number one, I have yelled at her. I wish that she would only have eyes for me. I may have silently stared at her. She has thought that I made fun of her. Sometimes I don't answer her when she wants to talk to me. That's domestic violence. I have felt that she is a nag. The Japanese word is kuchi-urusai. Kuchi-urusai to motta koto ga aru. Omotta. We're not saying, if you think that, we're talking thought police here. If you ever think that she's a nag, that's domestic violence. Look, you might be able to make a case that some of these things are examples of domestic abuse, but look, where I come from, it's not violence unless somebody touches you or there's a blow to the body. Everybody watched People's Court. Judge Wapner, the first thing he says is somebody was violent towards me, he said, did you touch him? And he says, yes, okay, there's a chance of violence. If he didn't touch, it's not violence. But I've heard in Japanese, boruku wa bougen da. I've heard that rough language is violence. Bougen wa bouruku da. This is getting to be too gray. Now, the source on this is a person by the name of Dr. Numazaki Ichiro. Why do men choose violence? There's a leading question for our title, right? Naze otoko wa bouryoku wo irabu no ka is the Japanese. You can get it on Amazon. According to Professor Numazaki, the producer of this list, a check mark next to even one item indicates a DV event. For women who checked off one item, they have been a victim of DV, and for men, any checks indicate that the man is a perpetrator of DV. Yeah. See how... Do you see how the debate is getting gray? There's no checklist for men to say that they've ever been a victim of violence. No, the men are always a perpetrator in this situation. And what's the problem here? Well, I mean, what's the henpecked husband's wife's village? Rolling pin. Come on, violence happens on both sides, but not according to how the debate's going. It's going to disadvantage fathers ever further. And I see Steve right there, slowly yet surely changing, very puce-colored in his face, because it's like he's experienced all of these arguments. And this is very enervating for you, I'm sure, but it's got to come out. This is my harsh conclusion to all of this. I cannot recommend anyone, regardless of nationality, marry under this system and have children. I stress, this is not a Japanese, non-Japanese issue. This is a flawed marriage and divorce system. The risk is too great. It's too great. You're going to lose your kids if you get divorced. Those are the chances in this society. All right, those are my kids. That's my memory of my kids. I haven't seen them much since my separation in 2003. I haven't seen them hardly at all since our divorce in 2006. It took several years before the divorce came through. But that's how I remember them. That's 1996. I haven't had any updates. I haven't even had any new photos. I cannot see them. I cannot call them. Some might say, well, why don't you just go there? I'm not going to stalk my kids. I'm not going to terrorize them. I mean, I want to be able to see them and talk to them and, etc. But when you've had my ex-wife who will basically tell them a story about what happened, but it's not true, and never hear my side of the story, parental alienation syndrome is a common thing that happens. Because if only one person controls the debate, controls the issue, then you've got a very serious problem. And the fact that there's no guaranteed means to give your side of the story to your kids, or at least to convince your kids that, daddy's not such a bad guy after all, because you're able to see and talk to him and have fun with him, then parental alienation is normal. That's the natural outcome of everything. All right. In sum, Inappropriate is a novel about a very serious subject. Cases of a divorce anywhere are complicated, but I wanted to demonstrate how the current system in Japan encourages child abduction, both as a means of revenge and as an act of desperation. Revenge meaning the wife, in my book, the wife abducts, and in desperation where the husband tries to re-abduct. Everything in the book is based upon actual events. It's a fiction book, but non-fiction in terms of evidence. And the reason why I did that is because I didn't want to focus on only one case. It wouldn't show you how complicated everything is. So if I combined everything, then it would be a much better book, I thought. And it's my first work of fiction. One I hope you enjoy or will enjoy reading. I have three more novels currently in my head. Three. I'm going to try to release one per year. If you like this new direction, I hope to one day make a living from writing full time. Please consider reading and supporting both me and davito.org in the future. And again, my other books are these. There's those two there, and there's the others, other two there. You can download the PowerPoint presentation right here. I want to say thank you very much for attending this book break. Let's open up the floor to questions, comments. We don't have to talk about depressing things. Let's have fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It is depressing. What else can we say? But yes, I hope we'll find some grounds for hope. Maybe we can start if people have questions about the book, and then move on to the issue in general. Does anyone have any questions about the book? No.
Why not?
Okay, well, let's move swiftly on to the issue in general.
Well, I don't know. I think most of us have...
Yeah, mine could be good. I'm recording this for the podcast.
Thanks, it's been very interesting. Most of us haven't read the book. So it's difficult to ask questions about the book, what's in the book, okay, rather than the writing of it or that, without spoiling the story for ourselves and other people.
But, go on. If you want to ask a question about, you know, what went into the book, or how much of it is me and how much of it is not me, etc., things like that it's all fair game. If it's too personal, I'll beg off. Anybody else?
We have a couple of journalists here who have been very silent. Any questions?
Okay. Not about the book even? No. About anything?
Well, I have questions, but they're not about the book.
Well, please, go ahead. I think
Sorry, I was just trying to explain why people might not be very forthcoming with questions about the book. Well, speaking personally, that was my reservation. So I'd like to go back to what you said at the beginning, Debbie. You said that there are three categories of divorce, and you talked about the first two.
That's correct.
But I missed the third.
Yes, I neglected to mention it. Okay.
You could elaborate.
Of course. Please. The first one is the Kyogiri-kon, which is where both sides agree. You know, the Naritori-kon. You just say, okay, we don't like this. Inkan, done. The second type is where one side doesn't agree to it, and they want to go into some form of negotiation. It's an extra legal negotiation, which is called Choteri-kon. And it takes a while. You every month or two, you meet for a few hours at the courthouse. You have one person from the court. You have one person from the bureaucracy, and you have one, maybe two, what they call yushikisha, which are people of awareness that they bring in off the street, essentially, to sit there and enjoy the drama. And they offer advice to both sides about how they should or should not stay together. Usually they're like, well, you know, you think you should put this in perspective. Maybe you should not be so hard on each other, type of thing. The tendency is for that's how they're going to... Default is not divorce. So you have to go and say, well, here's why. Because we're broken. Our relationship is broken. And it will alienate the other partner and make them want to seek revenge very often. Because it's like, well, if you're going to say this about me, I'm going to say this about you, sort of thing, right? And that's just, then once that happens, if eventually the both sides get talked out and they still don't, they still don't agree, then it goes to the third stage. And the third stage is where you take it to Saiban. You take it to the courts, the family court, and then you make your same case again on the legal footing instead of a personal one, and the judge will rule or not, however long it takes, whether or not your relationship is broken. Okay, Mark, back. Go ahead, follow up.
Yeah, and typically takes how many years? My divorce, 3 years.
My divorce, 3 years. Yeah.
So that second stage that you just explained, is that what's called mediation?
Yes. And mediation, very few divorces actually go all the way to court. Most of them will either be that mutual agreement or mediation. 85%, I think, is the figure. But the ones that go through mediation will take a long, long time, and then you got court on top of that. But once you've actually broken your relationship, in other words, you've made the argument this relationship's broken, then you got hard feelings after it, then the parental abduction happens. And then once a parental abduction happens, you don't see your kids anymore, you ask the state, you know, I've had to make this case to the state that our relationship's broken, now we've soured the waters, please help me see my kids now. Now the state doesn't intervene. After the state meddles to try and get you to satisfy their requirements for why a relationship shouldn't continue, they won't allow a relationship to continue with your kids. And that's a fundamental flaw in the system. Okay, does that answer your question, Anne?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, more questions, please. Okay,
yes, sir. So you have Japanese nationality.
Yes. Yes, I do.
And it didn't make any difference in terms of writing dissertation.
Not one whit.
Am I right? This is the problem with Japanese society, regardless of nationality.
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. Is that it? You wanted me to say no so you could talk more?
Then, even if Japanese government signed the Hague Treaty,
right,
that doesn't make any difference.
That's right.
What should be done?
What should be done is we have to have joint custody. I think we should. You want the radical view? All right. My radical solution is abolish the Koseki system.
Oh,
yeah. Of course it is. But that's what you or you amend the laws to allow joint custody for kids to be on two Kosekis. And enforce joint visitation rights. And make it so that there is a fairness to the hearings. That you have to enforce perjury laws, because if somebody lies in court, he committed domestic violence against me, and there's no evidence, we have to at least give the benefit of the doubts that the innocent until proven guilty type of thing. And if somebody lies in court, they will be prosecuted for lying, you know? Things like that. We're talking about a fundamental standard of evidence that you just don't have in any case in this society. So with the Hague, I don't see Japan giving more rights to foreigners than they do to their own citizens. You see? If the Hague is signed and suddenly an international marriage has more rights of custody and access and visitation than regular Japanese do, something screwy there, isn't it? So you have to not only sign the Hague, you have to increase the rights for everybody in the society. That's how deep the problem goes. Mm. Follow up? You okay?
I just comment. One problem with the Hague, though. I mean, the embassies are pushing Japan to sign. The embassies are, and I say embassies because it's not like a bilateral problem between the U.S. or Japan. There's been a number of joint demarches with the last one, I think, was 23 countries when you include the EU also joined into the joint demarche. But they've been pressing Japan to join the Hague in the hope that Japan will change its domestic law. And as David Rose said, that's fundamentally what needs to happen, is Japan needs to change the family law in Japan. The other thing that I'd like to say is about the domestic violence. These charges of domestic violence, there's the one problem of just perjury, you know, although they're not in the court of law, but basically they're filing false police reports is what they're doing. And the charge of domestic violence, it's just an administrative thing. The police do not investigate. They go down to the kuyakcho or the shiakcho. They get a form, fill it out, say, oh, there's domestic violence. The kuyakcho says, okay, take it to the police. They say, oh, okay, got it. They hanko it, give it back. The person takes it back to the kuyakcho, and then that's it. You've been accused of domestic violence. There's no police investigation. There's no substantiation whatsoever. It's just basically hearsay. But once it's been done, you are administratively locked out from all information about your child. And it's a tool that the attorneys are advising the people who have abducted their children. So once you abduct them, how do you keep them and hide them away? The lawyers say, well, charge domestic violence. And then you can hide away and they'll never be able to find you because you won't be able to get any information again. Where they're registered, where the kids are going to school, which you have a right to know as a parent. But with the false charge of domestic violence, you're cut out from all that information.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hello, Simon Scott, Freelance Journalist. Yeah, just wondering, what do you think are the historical roots of this system that's developed, whereby joint custody is kind of a non-option? I mean, in terms of where has this come from? In terms of, is it something intrinsic that's built into the sort of Japanese legal system, or is it come out of a wider series of cultural beliefs or something about how children should be raised? Or do you have any ideas on that topic?
I do. I think it's a relic of the Ye Sedo, right? The Ye Sedo, where Ye is a household, and during the Ye Sedo,
house
system. When I'm speaking in English, you click back into Japanese. It always sounds kind of funny. You ever notice? Okay. When you're speaking, when you're rattling away in Japanese, it's normal. Okay. Ye Sedo, there it goes again, is a system which was from I would say, Tokugawa days, even before Tokugawa.
Even before.
We're talking about hundreds of years, where families were essentially legal units to themselves. For example, if the head of household, the Setainushi, I assume they still call them back then, say the old crusty grandfather who is in his 70s, he sees his son or grandson marrying a woman he didn't like, he could actually force them to divorce. He would actually be able to legally declare them divorced. If you had a situation, and there was a lot of arranged marriages and things like that going on. But the point is, historically, households have been a lot, because they were all onto themselves, there was a high divorce rate in Japan. This is a called Harald Fuess, F-U-E-S-S, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, Harald Fuess, I think he's Danish. He did a book called Divorce in Japan, very good book, in which he's talking about why the divorce laws of 1898 were promulgated. And the reason was is because during the Meiji Restoration and during the Meiji era, word got around from all the Christian countries out there saying, looking at Japan, they're like, gosh, Japan divorces a lot. Gosh, what's wrong with this country? The embarrassment that was felt by the elites was that, well, we're going to make divorce a bit more difficult now. Of course, women were still property. Women were still property in most countries way back then. They had no right to vote. They had no right to divorce. They had no right to be anything but, Josai Kempo, strong mothers and good wives. But they at least made it so that the state could say to those particular households that you cannot divorce unless you give us a good reason. You cannot be a law unto yourself. You must give us, I don't have my handbook in front of me, but there's like 5 to 7 different reasons for getting divorce. One is futenakoi, what's futenakoi? Infidelity or disappearance. Like, for example, dies in a war. Wait for 3 years, nobody appears.
Desertion.
Nowadays, you can get divorced for drug use, arrests, alcohol abuse, drunk driving. You can get fired and divorced for those sorts of grounds. Infidelity works in the case of men. In other words, if a man's unfaithful.
Where can you get fired?
You can get fired. Oh, you want to know? If I'm in Hokkaido, for example, I've seen many of my colleagues that have been out drunk driving, and as soon as they're arrested for drunk driving, they go mente, they lose their license, and they even get fired. Yeah. It's grounds.
For driving drunk, yes, but you mentioned for infidelity.
For men, if a man is unfaithful to a woman, she can go to court and say he's unfaithful. And in fact, in Japan, you can actually even sue the girlfriend. The ex-wife can sue the girlfriend for family wrecking and demand money from her in court. Yeah, here it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if it's a man's side, if a woman does not engage in sex or get children, you can also use that as grounds for divorce too in Japan. Those are cultural things, but the things that have been stipulated by the government as grounds for divorce. But again, they haven't been updated since 1898, and they were designed to make divorce more difficult. And to make it within the realm of the state, as opposed to within the realm of the family. Now, you can still see issues like the remnants of the Ye Sedo in the way that police enforce laws. For example, in cases of domestic violence, the police are very reluctant to intervene. You can go to the police and say, look, my wife is beating my children, or my husband beats me. And the police are going to probably say, well, work it out amongst yourselves. Until somebody gets injured in a knife fight, or gets killed or something like that, or there's actual marks, then the police are probably going to just say, oh, somebody's exaggerating. He said, she said, in Japanese, the mizukakero. Because everyone assumes that there's a lie going on and everybody's exaggerating because it's, you know, crimes of passion, heat of the moment type of thing. When there's actual death or injury, then there might be an intervention. But even then, police are sort of like, woo-hoo-hoo, privacy issues, we're not going to get involved. So there's remnants of it. But now with the awareness of DV, especially for the political reasons that we're seeing in order to loophole our way out of the Hague Treaty, we're seeing DV being raised very unsophisticatedly as grounds for intervention and basically doing what's to keep maintaining the status quo and not enforcing the Hague. Does that answer your question, Simon?
Yeah.
Okay, we have something to follow up there?
Well, yeah, I'd just like to also as far as, you know, children being able to see their parents and parents being able to have access to their children and the head. Japan is already a signatory to the UNCRC, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children, and the Diet has ratified that treaty. Being an international treaty, it's the highest law in the land. It's higher than the Tokyo To law or any Minato-ku law or even any Japanese domestic law. This is a higher law than any of those. Article 9 of the UNCRC says, children have a right not to be separated from their parents. And yet the courts, in my case, my child was abducted by my wife. My wife is a shacho here in Tokyo, company president, so she can't leave Tokyo. But yet my son, being 10 years old when he was abducted, could easily have come back to my house. He knew where I lived. He could ride the trains by himself, no problem. So she had to take him far enough away that he couldn't come to my house by himself. But she couldn't leave Tokyo. So she sent him to live with another family in Osaka, a family I had never met before, a family that my son had never met before. And the Tokyo Family Court knew this. They went to visit him in that family. And they knew that he was being denied all access, all communication, and yet they allowed that to prevail for 3 years. Now, that's a clear dereliction of duty on the parts of the judge and the courts, the investigators. They turned a blind eye. They are not in compliance with international laws of which they have signed. So what hope is there that Japan is going to honor the Hague Convention on the civil aspects of international parental child abduction? Zero, in my mind. The other thing is that the Hague is not retroactive. All these cases that have been, that we have been able to bring now to the public light and to scrutiny will not be addressed under the Hague. There's nothing, the Hague only comes into force after Japan signs, and then it only deals with future cases.
Okay, thank you.
I have a quick question. Obviously, this book will do hopefully a lot to raise further awareness amongst non-Japanese readers primarily. But the key issue seems to be how to raise awareness amongst Japanese of the negative impacts of this current system on children. What are your thoughts on how that can be done?
Well, I think people that are here can attest that many Japanese parents, left behind parent isn't like left behind foreign parent, it's left behind parent, and left behind Japanese, both male and female, left behind non-Japanese, both male and female, are actually stirring up trouble. But the difficulty is in this sort of situation is that people don't really want necessarily to stir up trouble because, some of these things take years sometimes to negotiate, and very often because of the parental alienation, the kid doesn't want to see their mother or father again type of thing. That's what's happened in my situation, alas. I have, in my situation, I've got two daughters. You saw the pictures earlier tonight. They're now 15 and 17 years old. I've talked to them over the past 5 years about four times. And I've even been in some situations that require intervention by the authorities. My ex-wife is a hoarder. She has filled the house with it. A hoarder. A person that hoards things.
A pack rat.
A person that hoards things is somebody that can't throw something out. She can't throw anything out, so the house becomes full of garbage. And that's what my house... I don't live there anymore. I've let them live there. After the divorce agreement, I said, okay, my ex-wife...
But she at least threw you up.
That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. Oh, well, there's the soda I go me out, right? Put me on the doorstep like a refrigerator, right? But, that's really good.
Sorry. No.
We have to laugh about these sorts of things. We need these laughs because if not, this stuff becomes dire and you just want to slit your wrists, right? Let's laugh about this because it's absurd. My ex-wife and my kids are living in the house that I built. I spent a lot of money on it. I didn't want to throw my children out of their childhood home, right? But when I went back there, I found out that the house had become full of garbage and they're living in a house full of cat shit. There's cat shit and cat pee. The house smells horrible. I don't know how they're living in it. They can't get into some rooms because they're blocked with garbage. So I went to the authorities. And I said, help. I went to the Hokkinjo, the Department of Public Health. I took photographs. I took 200 photographs of all the garbage in the way. At first they said, well, yeah, there's a problem here. Let's look into it. A month later, after talking it over with my ex, and not ever going into the house or anything, and I said, okay, well, no, there's no real problem here. It's a privacy issue. And I said, how could this be? If your kids were living in this filth, would you do nothing? They dropped it, yes, sir?
Another silly question.
Yeah.
Why didn't you just throw it out?
Because, all the garbage, you mean?
Yes. You were still living there, right?
I was not living there.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Living there?
While I was living there, it wasn't the pigsty when I was living there. After I left, this was 5 years later. 5 years is plenty of time for garbage to build up, and it did. And, I said, okay, do I have to, take this to it? Is this child abuse? And they said, well, you can take it to the child abuse authorities. Okay, who are they? Well, that's us. Same people, because it's a small town. The authorities wouldn't do anything about it. These are situations that you see time and again where people refuse to enforce, common sense laws or common sense ordinances. And in Steve's case, you saw the point where somebody with, not even a legal guardian would be allowed to have custody of the children. That's insane. And how can we improve this sort of situation for Japanese people too? Lots of other people deal with these sorts of situations as well. And it actually convinces everybody when it seems to be the norm. And besides, now that my kids are 15 and 17, it's been 10 years. And so, we've grown apart and don't really know each other anymore. So you fight for the right to see them and then you don't have anything, what do we talk about now, sort of thing. The damage has been done through parental alienation. So at that point, you have a lot of mush about the nice stuff going on, right? Because if you fight for years to see your kids only to have them not want to see you, that's very disheartening. So people just say, all right, screw it, I'll start over, I'll marry somebody else and have kids with somebody else. That seems to be the normal way. Go ahead, Steve.
I can just, as far as like the Kodomo Sodan Center, the Child Protective Services, in my case, I had audio recording of a phone conversation where my wife is actually physically threatening, or verbally threatening to kill my son. And they did nothing. Here was my, her own voice saying, I want to kill you, I want to kill your father. And the, Child Protective Services just, dismissed it. They didn't even, and the court as well, didn't take the child's abuse that, the abducting parent was doing, they didn't acknowledge the evidence.
Right. Sorry, I think there's a few questions. Joel, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Hi, Joel Lejean Cuisine.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh my goodness, hello. I read your blog today. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Just a question about spouse visa, permanent visa. When the person gets married, he's a Japanese citizen, he can get a spouse visa or he has his company visa or whatever. But my question is, when you have a spouse visa and you get a child, is there some kind of specific things put on your visa or passport or whatever that may allow you to avoid things? Because as you say, if there's a divorce, the guy loses the spouse visa of the girl, the wife or the husband, foreigner, lose the spouse visa, then what happened? He can't stay here anymore, right? Unless he has a child visa. So, is there some legal work to do here? I mean, lawyers have some window, as we say, to something to work out, so that when you have a child, something could be open to have a new specification or legal things. What do you think? Do you understand my question, and what do you think you could do?
Oh, well, of course, have special grant special privileges for people that have... do you want to add something to this?
No.
Okay. Grant special privileges for family reasons, for example. But as you saw in something, what was that? I'm forgetting her name right now. The person that was going to a Japanese school, a daughter of two visa overstayers, and the parents had to be sent back home, but she could stay in Japan by herself. I'm blanking on her name right now.
Oh, the minor.
Sorry? Noriko Kogan. Thank you. I knew somebody would know this. We're in a room of informed people. The Noriko Kogan case, her parents, even this seems tangential, but we're talking about visas right here. She could stay because she had schooling types of things, but her parents could not because they were illegal aliens. In other words, they didn't have the status of residents. They were overstayers. So they had been overstaying for 11 years. They were booted out of the country. Now, this had to go through the justice minister himself. This took a lot of local grassroots coordination by people, and it caused a big stir. We had people on both sides of the barricades saying, boot out this illegal alien. They were comparing it to people coming to America, Mexicans coming to America, having a baby that's a Japanese citizen, thanks to, being at juice solely rights. And then having it, bringing themselves to this country as a non-citizen grounded by a citizen. And that's what people are saying they'd like to avoid. They don't want to say that, okay, just because you have a child here, that gives you any special rights, because what if everybody just trying to impregnate Japanese women so they can stay in this country is the logic that would be given back to you.
That's the case here.
It would be the case if somebody made that argument, I think.
Because it can be worked on in other countries. Mm-hmm. It's worked with lawyer.
Yeah. I would say. So I would say that what needs to be done here is give some special case-by-case types of concessions to people that have family issues, like a son or a daughter that they'd like to keep in contact with. But if you can't even have a visitation right, how can you envision them having even the right of residency just based upon the child? Lots of work to be done, as you say, sir. Okay, is there a follow-up, or does that answer your question?
I'd like to go back to the cultural aspect. As an Italian, I also belong to a country where usually kids are given to women when they divorce, and where fathers usually don't take very much care of them, unless they make money and eat the baby. But Italy has changed a lot recently. We have now double custody, we have a fair legal situation. I myself, my own personal story, so I can speak from high. I'm an expert in that. What really strikes me is the Japanese men, not the Japanese women. How many Japanese men, especially in big cities, Tokyo, I'm not talking about the foreigners, maybe the foreigners are in a better situation here, bigger house. How many divorced fathers, salary men, who lives 1 hour from the company, are able to entertain a non-custodial parent's relation with their kids? Mm-hmm. In other words, when I used to get my kids for the weekend, I went
to their school, pick them up in front of the school on Saturday, bring them with my own car to my own big house, and stay there for the weekend, and then bring them back in the Monday morning to school directly. They had a room in my house, they had you know, other brothers and sisters to play with. How could you imagine doing this in Tokyo situation for a salaryman that has been kicked out from by his wife, or you know, they, he just didn't want to live together. He lives in a small, how will you call it, your English, rabbit hutch or whatever. Yes. Yes. And what does it do with the kid? You cannot take kids in restaurants in this country. You cannot take kids at, you know. I mean, that's true. I mean, yeah. You can.
Take children to restaurants.
Oh, yeah, bring them to restaurants, nice restaurants. I'm not talking about McDonald's. Sorry, I'm talking about real restaurants.
Well, I wasn't talking about McDonald's either.
Okay, anyway, there is a social handicap, social obstacle to perform the role of a separated parent here in Japan. And this applies especially to the men, because women are much smarter, they are much more, you know, able to manage the emergency, they can do 3-4 things all together, they can wash dishes, write a story, make the laundry, and still invest money. Men cannot in Japan do this. I'm sorry, I never saw a Japanese change his diapers.
Okay. Well, I did. But here, just to give you, I'll just to ground this in some statistics. Please look up at the board. I managed to find this during. Thanks for talking so much. It helped me search. In Japan, divorces defined less than 2007. Fathers got custody 15% of the time, while women got custody 81% of the time. The difference in numbers would probably be grandparents. So the system is clearly biased, but men win in a significant, if not fair, number of cases. Interestingly, men used to get custody more often than women. The sexes reached parity in the late 1960s, and women reached their current 80% success rate around 2000. Here are the stats. Here are the census figures from comparing to the
moment. This is totally different.
Of course, it's totally different, but I thought it'd still be interesting.
It's totally different. Mm-hmm. In Italy, this is 90%, 95%. It's even more biased. Mm-hmm. But in Japan, the reason why the men get more is because of money, because they buy it.
Okay. All right.
They take the kids because they want to have kids, and women are paid off. That's different.
Okay.
Totally different.
All right. FYI. Yes, ma'am.
I've heard that the gender of the child will sometimes influence the mother, the father. Often the father wants to take the... but often the father, I've heard, wants to take the son to pass that on. Actually, this happened in my own family. My own family was divorced, and there was not an argument about what... There was a son and a daughter, and there was not an argument about where the daughter would go. It seemed like the father didn't care, but the son was... point of contention. So, do you know anything about that?
I don't. I'm afraid I don't have any statistics like that that I can bring up to give you. And I'm not really sure. I think it's a matter of personal preference, how close you are to your child. I think I was closer to one of my daughters than my other. And that wasn't the gender issue. It was just a personality issue. Sometimes you might say, yes, family lineage, you'd want to keep your son with you, sort of thing. Sure, of course. But I don't know if... I'm not sure there's any surveys on that. I'm not sure there's any... Can anybody speak to that?
I'd just like to comment. You know, I don't think... that should be a non-issue. The point of, like, UNCRC, a child has a human right to access to both of their parents. You know, the parents bickering and squawking, you know, aside. A child has a right to be with both of their parents and not be denied access to either one of them. And that's why what's needed here is joint custody and some kind of parenting plan.
For sure.
Yeah.
I just wanted... it was kind of a chin and tilt.
I it's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. I mean, you know, we're thinking, you know, who's going to get the custody? You know, it should be a non-issue. The child should be able to see both of them because they have an innate right to.
Is there a text about that somewhere? Is this written somewhere?
Yeah, the UNCRC. Here, I can give you a summary of the UNCRC.
Thanks.
And you can have that.
Do we have this part of your time?
I've sent you an email with a link. If you want to put some faces behind this, there's a photo project that I just sent you just like minutes ago.
with faces of left behind parents with pictures of their kids, if you want to put like a face to this.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. All right.
So maybe one last question.
Only one last question.
Well,
stick around.
I don't see 20 guys at the moment.
He's going to hand your voice to Simon again. Okay. And then Simon.
Please. Well, just briefly, in response to what you said, a friend of mine recently got divorced, and it was the other way around. The father got the daughter, and the son was with her. The father's Japanese. She's not. But anyway, but I mean, I think everybody's. So no, not necessarily. I would say. So thanks for the historical rationale, and I'd like to ask you why you think it is that the law hasn't changed since 1898, mm-hmm. and you know if that. Sorry if that sounds a rather sort of simple and naive question with perhaps a long, or I don't know whether a complicated answer.
I'll try.
And is it, I mean, because the whole Prosecco system, is it, it just seems like a vicious circle. From what you described that, you know, joint custody can't happen but because of the law, you know, children can only be on one or the other, etc.
To answer the question as best I can, again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a guy with a big mouth who's been through a number of experiences and is happy to impart what he knows to you. The divorce laws have not essentially changed since 1898. The marriage laws have changed somewhat. 1947, there was a huge revision. Why? Because they abolished the IE Seidel, the household system in 1947, thanks to Bundy MacArthur. They said, okay, women are not property anymore, women and men are equal, and women can divorce men too. Under the IE Seidel, women could not divorce. Again, this was de rigueur in other countries too. But so marriage has changed, and obviously, as you can see right here, as I put up there, that women were also denied custody a lot of their own children for quite some time. Now it's flipped on its head, so things have changed in that regard. But why haven't the divorce laws changed? Because I don't think the state likes divorce. I think the state believes that, marriage is a good thing and divorce is a bad thing because if you divorce, then things get messy. People should not divorce unless they have a really, really, really good reason. What are those really good reasons? Well, we have these here. Can you think of any more? All right, well, they don't get along. Oh, that's not good enough. How can you systematize, you know, irreconcilable differences? I don't know, so we're just not going to touch it. I think the state has taken upon itself to offer disincentives to divorce. To say that, okay, after all, what happens to the children? After all, after the divorce, the state has an interest in saying, let's not confuse people with, you know, two parents, one parent being there, one parent not being there. Let's just make that child the province of one parent. Makes it a lot easier, in that sense, for the child. And in fact, my ex-wife got remarried. And my children were adopted by another person. And the interesting thing was I didn't even hear about it. Nobody told me. In other societies, because I'm paying child support, I should be told about these sorts of things so that I can actually know whether I have to pay more or less child support. If there's another person who's adopted my children, I shouldn't have to pay the same amount of child support. But nobody told me. And when I eventually found out, you know, I have to take it to court in order to say, okay, I want my money back, sort of thing, right? So, there's all sorts of really wacky things going on here, but the incentive is on you to marry and stay married, and if you want a divorce, well, serves you right. Everything that happens to you after you divorce is your own fault because you divorced. So if all these things happen to you, BFD and too bad. So those are all, again, all disincentives. Hang on, Steve. We have Simon wants to talk next. But, okay, does that answer you? That's the best I can do for an answer. How's that?
Yes, thank you.
All right, then. Yes, Simon?
Yeah, I just wondered, is there much of a grassroots sort of movement amongst left behind Japanese parents that is sort of, you know, similar? Because it sort of seems to me if this whole thing is really actually going to kind of change for the better, it's going to probably be driven by a sort of a grassroots movement amongst Japanese left behind parents. Because let's be honest about it, I mean, foreigners in this country don't have voting rights, and so obviously in terms of making, you know, what sort of incentive do political parties have to sort of push changes in legislation? Without there being a real sort of grassroots movement amongst the Japanese people.
All right, that's interesting. You can speak to that better than me. You're the activist.
There are a number of Japanese grassroots organizations. There's Kyoto Shinken Network, or KNET as we call it. There's Oyakonet. There's Father's website, which is down in the Nagoya area. There's also like an Oyakonet in Kansai, the Osaka area, as well as in Tokyo here. So there are a number. You know, we're fighting a kind of against the culture as well. The Japanese educational system educates, you know, Japanese, you know, don't question authority. You know, the nail that gets, you know, stands up is going to get hammered down, and they learn that from day one of school. So they're not culturally inclined to question authority. You don't, you know, the judge says you can't see your kid anymore. They just accept it. So, you know, we've been working years now to try and, you know, build up the grassroots organizations here, and it's starting to take effect. And kind of getting back to your question, the family law is changing, we're very hopeful it's going to change soon. I've been going for the past 2 years to the Diet, lobbying. There's Shimo Moto-sensei, who's a LDP, the first step in making a law in Japan is a Diet member has to start a Kenkyukai, a study group. So Shimo Moto-sensei started one 2 years ago. Most recently, Hase-sensei has started one since the middle of last year. And I think also this is a consequence of a lot of pressure being put on Japan to sign the Hague Convention. They realize that they need to change the domestic family law. And that's what's in the works right now. So we're hopeful within the next year or two there will be new family law.
But I don't want to sell short the power of Gaiatsu here, pressure from overseas, because very often, you know, when something appears in the New York Times saying, my goodness, this is awful, or when somebody's, the divorce laws came about in 1898 due to the elites and their feelings about divorce being seen negatively. One way to raise awareness is when several countries actually stand up and say, look, what you're doing here is wrong. But as you say, it has to take effect within Japan as well, within the electorate, otherwise, you know, it's not going to be perfect. However, let's not sell short the effect of Japan's reputation overseas. After all you really need to do if you want to play a dirty pool in the debate arena is say, isn't it ironic how Japan keeps on claiming victim status for all the North Korean people have been abducted, and yet there's 300 children abducted every year to Japan by Japanese? That's dirty pool, but it can be. It's politics. And if you make that comparison in the press enough, you're going to get people in the Japanese press going to go, that's racist, you're being mean to us, we're victims of North Korea. Well, aren't these children also victims? No, they're Japanese citizens, they're just being repatriated from abusive foreign fathers. Ooh, it gets even dirtier. So the debate heats up, but it's because of Gaiatsu, because of pressure from overseas, that this has, I believe, become an issue at all. Because everyone's just knuckling under otherwise. It's the norm. Okay, does that answer your question, sir? Okay, thank you.
Okay, how are we doing? Anyone else want to make a burning comment or a question?
Does anybody want to ask a question not dealing with this so we end on a more positive note?
Okay, I think we've had an extremely interesting discussion, and I've certainly learned a lot. And I have one positive suggestion, which is about using the committee, the Convention on the Rights of the Child reporting system. As you probably know, NGOs can submit alternative reports to Geneva, and that is another way of putting international pressure on the government. But yeah, I'd like to thank Debito very much, and as is the custom, he is being presented with an extremely generous token for hospitality in this very establishment. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming, and let's join together and thank Debito very much.
Thank you very much, everybody.